Well, I want to thank Pastor Reeder for opening the door for me to be here. And I want to thank you for inviting me, and I want to ask all of you to go to Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8. As I was introduced, Reverend James Power Smith, some of you may actually know me better as Captain James Smith. I got to know Thomas J. Jackson, T.J. Jackson, General Jackson, General Stonewall Jackson. I got to know him. Winchester of 1861. It was there that I left divinity school and came over and joined his fledgling army, called the Army of the Valley, wasn't much more than about 1,500 men at the time. We met and we began to talk. We talked very little about military matters. All he wanted to ask me about was theology. Our hearts were knit together, and the next thing I know, I'm a captain, no longer a private. And then the next thing I know, I'm on his staff. And then became a wonderful 3 years that I had the opportunity to get to know him. And if I could tell you on his behalf, I've got you right in the passage that was his favorite passage of Scripture. It was Romans 8:28. Now I'm going to ask you to read it through with me concerning its context, which includes verses 29 and 30. So if you'll look at it with me, and then I want to tell you why this became the life verse Thomas J. Jackson. Romans 8:28. Many of you know it by heart. Let me go ahead and read it for you. And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good. For those who are called according to his purpose, for those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, in order that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. And those whom he predestined, he also called. And those whom he called, he also justified. And those whom he justified, he also glorified. Well, now being a preacher, and I pastor First Presbyterian Church, Fredericksburg, I've been there 29 years. My uncle-in-law is a pastor that was actually the chaplain of the 2nd Corps of the Army of Northern Virginia. His name was Beverly Tucker Lacey. Married his niece. And so I have I'm just Presbyterian through and through, and I don't know how I got invited to a Baptist church, but here I am. Here I am. Been pastoring this church at Fredericksburg. The church had a revival when I was a captain, 1862 and 1863. That church and Grace Episcopal Church right outside of town, along with Round Oak Baptist Church, combined for the preaching of the word every single day in the winter camps of the Army of Northern Virginia. There were 21,000 professions of faith, over 19,000 baptisms. And now a few of those you may not have counted, but we did. And there was an enormous outpouring of the Spirit of God. Little did I know I would be back at that church as a pastor after the war, ordained, serving the Lord. And then we've had another revival since then. But I can't tell you there's probably no more influence of the gospel of grace in my life than the years I spent with Thomas J. Jackson. I went ahead and finished my seminary and ordination after the war, but when I was with him, I learned so much. The campfires were constant theological discussions. I'll never forget the time after we had finished what's now called the Valley Campaign, and we were at Wires Cave. And he was, everyone was recuperating from having marched in 60 days, 800 miles. 800 miles in 60 days, fought 14 battles and defeated four armies, all of them bigger than ours. And so we went to Wires Cave, and lo and behold, a revival broke out. It was an amazing time. And I can remember it vividly. I can also remember one night they were sitting around a campfire at Wires Cave, and they were discussing. A new book had just come out, and it had arrived in America, and some of our troops and officers had read it. It was called The Origin of the Species by a guy by the name of Charles Darwin. And so we began to discuss it. And they turned and they asked General Jackson what he thought of it. He said, let me study upon the matter and pray about it. That was not unusual, so he left the camp. Well, as soon as he left the camp, General A.P. Hill and Richard Ewell began to make fun of him. Sometimes in behind his back, we'd call him Tom Fool, the blue light elder of the Presbyterian Church, the religious fanatic. But he sure had shown us a lot in that campaign, and we began to listen to him a lot closer. But what was really interesting is that when he left, I remember Richard Ewell said at the campfire, "Well, I guess old Tom Jackson has gone to pray for us heathen." And so what I didn't know till I found out later was that Richard Ewell actually, when he left, decided to go by the tent. When he went by the tent, he did find Tom Jackson on his knees in prayer. He was the most praying man I ever met in my life. There he was on his knees in prayer, praying for every single general that had been at that campfire, the discussion. Richard Ewell said later, he said, "I don't have much to do with religion, but if I ever decided to have any, I want Tom's." But it was just a couple of months later, Richard Ewell lost his leg at 2nd Manassas. And he went home to recuperate. And he was reading the tracts and pamphlets that Thomas Jackson had given to him. And his distant cousin came to bring him back to health. And Thomas Jackson's witness and his prayers proved effective. Richard Ewell came to Christ, was baptized, rejoined the army. We used to have to strap him on his horse because he couldn't stay on it with just one leg. When he came back after Jackson had died, and he became the general to succeed, the general that in his prayer life had led the way for him to come to Christ. Would you like for me to tell you all the stories that I could tell you about that? Boy, I would love to. But maybe you ought to know why Romans 8:28 is so important. Now, the context is absolutely phenomenal. If you read the context, there's this great promise that belongs just to believers, and that's this. We know, here's something you can know, that God causes all things to work together for good. God never promises all things are good. Any preacher that tells you that, just dismiss them. That all things work together for good. Anything that can happen to an unbeliever except for God's condemning judgment can and does happen to believers. We get sick, we die, we lose jobs, we do all of those things. But here's what we know, that God causes all things to work together for good to those who are called according to His purpose. And the reason we know that is because those whom God has foreknown, He predestined. And those whom He predestined, He's called. And those whom He's called, He justified. And those whom He's justified, He glorified. From eternity past, whom He foreknew into eternity future. He doesn't lose one. It's an unbreakable chain. And the reason why is because He sent His firstborn, only Son. And His Son came, and all that the Father gives to Him, He has secured them. And no one can snatch them out of His hand. And He will take them to glory. So the firstborn will bring, the firstborn, God's Son, will bring many sons to glory. And when He brings them, He'll bring them through troubled times. I love the song we sang a while ago that just laid it out. And but yet God brings us through those times, and He's actually growing us through those times. Well, I saw that no more than God causing all things to work together for good in the life of Thomas J. Jackson. He was born in Clarksburg, Virginia. Now, I wasn't with him. I didn't know him until 1861. But I did know about him, and I found out about him. I've written about him. I get invited to speak about him all the time. And so I familiarized myself with his background. He was born. His father, when he was 2 years old, died. Jonathan Jackson. So Thomas Jackson and his brother and his sister had a single-parent home. But their mother remarried a guy by the name of Woodson Wirt. And Mr. Wirt was a struggling lawyer or wannabe lawyer, and so part of the conditions for the marriage was that the children had to be orphaned. So Thomas Jackson and his brother were orphaned out to his uncle, Uncle Cummings, who owned a mill. And so they lived at Jackson, a little crossroads on the river where the mill was, Jackson's Mill. And they were raised by the uncle, and his sister was sent off somewhere else to an aunt, and was raised by the aunt. So he was an orphan at age 2. It was not the easiest life. In fact, he and his brother ran away one time. They went out on the, they ended up on the Ohio River cutting wood and selling it to steamships. But unfortunately, this adventuresome life as a teenager turned into malaria for both of them. So they came back home. No matter what they were facing back home, it was better than malaria on the river. So they came back. And unfortunately, the malaria took Thomas's brother a couple of years later. So now he's alone. But he got a good friend named Charlie, and Charlie's daddy was the son of a Baptist preacher, Brushy River Creek Baptist Church, and he got to be good friends and would slip over there to listen to that Baptist preacher preach, and that's when he first began to hear about Christianity, and he began to love it, but listen to it, but he wasn't committed to it, not by any means. But another thing he did was that this Baptist pastor had a library, and he used to go over there just because he wanted to read. In fact, Thomas never had any formal education. He had about 6 months of formal education. That was it. Everything else, he was just self-taught. In fact, the overseer, who was an African-American, the overseer of the Jackson Mill, that overseer, that African-American, taught him everything he knew and guided him in his reading and everything. And that's all the education he had. But he wanted to go to college. Well, he couldn't afford that, but he found out that he could go to West Point free, so he applied. And he got down to the last three, but he was passed over. But the guy that went that summer decided, this is not for me, and he left. And when he found out he left, then Thomas, this young kid, and by the way, when he was 16, he became a constable. Now, don't get excited about that. That meant he went around and collected debts. That's what he did. But he when he heard about it, he got permission, and he borrowed about $25. And that African-American overseer that had raised him up at Jackson's Mill went with him, and he took him all the way across the mountains. And they found, for the first time in his life, he saw a railroad, and he got on the railroad, and he rode the railroad up to Washington, and he met with Congressman Butler. And Congressman Butler was so impressed with him, he said, well, go on up there and see if you can get in. I'll give a letter to you. So he goes up, and sure enough, he finishes out the summer, and he makes it, and he gets his appointment. But the classes were way ahead of him. But he would stay up all night. Now, lights were out, so what he did was he would bank up the coal fires. And he would bank up the coal fires, and he would keep reading at night after lights out. That's probably what happened to his eyesight, because later he almost lost his eyesight. It was probably, some of my friends that know about this tell me it was very likely the searing heat from the coals, as he would try to get light, that were actually burning the cornea and all of those things that, well, my generation is starting to find out about. Well, as he gets the end of the first year, and he's last in his class, just barely makes it. He's at the cutoff line. He's number 54. Everybody below that is dismissed. But every year he kept rising until he got to his last year, and he finished 17th in his class. I remember what one of his classmates, you know him as General A.P. Hill. You've heard about him. General A.P. Hill made the comment. He said, you know, Thomas Jackson isn't much for socializing. In fact, he's very awkward. But if he'd have stayed in school one more year, I think he would have graduated number one. That's when he began to keep his book of maxims. And there were two that greatly affected my life. I want to share them with you. One of them was this: you can be, by God's grace, you can be what you resolve to be. Don't play the victim. And then another one that he had was this: never take counsel from your fears. Now, if you go over to the Virginia Military Institute, you'll see the Jackson Gate. You'll see that maxim, you can be what you resolve to be, over the gate at VMI where he taught later. But the one that meant the most to me is never take counsel from your fear. As a believer, I'm not allowed to fear anything except the fear of God. The fear of God, which gives me what does the Bible tell me? Do not fear. Do not fear anything. Never take counsel from your fears, because the Bible even warns you, what you take counsel from with your fears will come upon you. And so that guided his life, and he made it through. And he wondered, how will I do in combat when I graduate? Well, he was 17, so that meant when we would graduate, when West Point graduates would come out, they had their choice of the branch of service, but it was according to your rank in class. Well, the top 15 in the class could choose to make the first choice, and they all chose the Corps of Engineers. That's where everybody went. Well, then you could choose the artillery or the cavalry or the infantry, and, well, Thomas Jackson chose the artillery, and boy, was he a natural-born artillerist. He went right into the Mexican War. He quickly rose from second lieutenant to captain and all the way to major, breveted three times for bravery. I'll never forget the time he's standing at Chapultepec. As he's standing at Chapultepec, he is outgunned, outmedaled, outweighed with the Mexican artillery that was up in the castle, and it was firing down on him. His entire battalion was shot to pieces until finally there was one gun left, and it had been almost disabled, and it was just Jackson and a sergeant. I remember that Thomas Jackson, the story came down to me, the other men write about it, that all of his company is there, wounded or dead. It's the sergeant and him, and they're down to one gun, and they're taking on that entire castle that's bristling with cannons, and they're firing back and forth at them. John Bankshead Magruder sent word that he had never seen such bravery before in his life, and Thomas Jackson, now Captain Jackson, soon to be Major Jackson, turned around and he said to the infantrymen that were behind him in the trenches, "Men, come up and help me." Well, nobody moved. And he said, "Men, if you'll come up and help me, you'll be saved. If you do your duty, you won't be killed." Well, infantrymen are dumb, but they're not that dumb. They looked out and they saw about 80-something artillerymen that had been doing their duty, and most of them were dead. It was about that time that actual cannonball left the walls of Chapultepec, came down, and went right through the legs of Thomas Jackson. He turned around and said, "See, if you'll do your duty, you won't be killed." Yet nobody moved. They still were not convinced. But he fought it to the end, and then after the war, he was breveted, as I mentioned, was all the way to major, but that's not the best thing that happened. The best thing that happened to him was Colonel Taylor. Colonel Taylor told him about a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. And it was in Mexico that Thomas Jackson gave his life and surrendered to Christ. Then he began to find out, well, what church am I going to join? So I'm in Mexico, I might as well check out the Roman Catholic Church. So he went around and checked it out, decided that wasn't a place for him. Never could really settle on anywhere, and he was there for quite a while. About that's where he learned to love citrus fruit, particularly lemons. And he got courted a couple of very fine-looking senoritas. Actually, contrary to what many people thought, became a good dancer, but he only do that in private. And then he left Mexico and he went up to Fort Hamilton. He was reunited with Colonel Taylor. And so he started going to the Episcopal Church where Colonel Taylor went. And what is really interesting, he started going to the church that 20 years earlier, Robert E. Lee had been the vestryman in that church when he built Fort Hamilton. Wasn't that interesting? That was kind of a precursor of something that was to come. And so there he is in that church, and he didn't feel comfortable joining the Episcopal Church, but they agreed to baptize him, so he went ahead and was baptized, but he still didn't join. He wasn't quite settled yet, and they moved him down to Florida. In Florida, he got a little disenchanted with the Army because there was a colonel that was engaged in immoral activity, and so Major Jackson brought charges against him, but the Army just kind of buried it in the process, and he became disenchanted, so he decided to get out. Decided he wanted to go teach somewhere. He heard there was an opening at the University of Virginia. Well, he really, being from Clarksburg, he really loved Virginia, so he said, "I'll try to go back there." And Robert E. Lee, actually, having seen his bravery in the Mexican War, wrote him a reference letter to send him up there, but somebody else beat him out for the job. But Robert E. Lee's son saw it and knew about Jackson, so Robert E. Lee's son forwarded the letter on to another school that had just begun in the 1830s in Virginia. It was a place called the Virginia Military Institute. And they were looking for a professor of natural philosophy. Now, over here at Auburn, I think y'all call that physics. And so he was going to teach physics, and that's That is what y'all call it at Auburn, right? Alabama, I don't know what, in fact, I don't even think they know what it is at Alabama. So he went ahead and he began to teach physics, and he was hired to do artillery. So he would train the VMI cadets in artillery. Well, he was a great artilleryman. He wasn't much of a physics professor at all. He did his best. He developed quite a habit of life. He would rise every morning at 6 o'clock. He did a 1.25 mile walk every morning at 6. And then he would come back after his walk, always take a cold bath. It did not matter what the temperature was, always took a cold bath every morning. And he had two dumbbells, wooden dumbbells, and he would do a series of exercises. And then he would get dressed, and then he would call everyone for together that was in the house with him. He would call them to morning prayers. And if you didn't show up on time, 7 o'clock, then the door was locked. You not only miss morning prayers, you miss breakfast. So he would then have morning prayers, and then he would have his uniform on, and he would make his walk by the colonnade of Washington College and then arrive at VMI, because both schools are right next to each other there in Lexington. And he would begin to teach. Now, when he would teach, how would he teach? Well, this is what he would do every day. After he would teach, let me tell you how he got what he was going to teach. He would come home after he had finished his classes at 1:30 every day, artillery practice and two classes that he would teach of physics. And then he would come back to his house. And when he'd come back to his house, he'd pitter around the garden a little bit. And then he had a stand-up desk, and he would go to his desk, and he would do his study for 2 hours. And he would commit everything to memory that he could for the next day. Just wasn't real comfortable with the subject, so the best thing to do is memorize it. And so he would memorize it, and then he would take a walk around, and he would take a carriage lane. When he got married, he would take his wife out for a carriage ride. He actually bought a little 10-acre farm, and it never would grow anything. Of course, if you go over there now, I can show you where the 10-acre farm is. It's a stone quarry today. No wonder it was so cheap. No wonder he couldn't grow anything. It's hard to get stone to bear fruit, I'll tell you. And so he would come back home, and then they would, you know, entertain at night. And then at 9:30, everybody had to be quiet. He'd turn his chair around, face the wall, get his notes, make sure he had it all memorized for the next 30 minutes. And then at 10 o'clock, he'd turn right around, and he'd make sure you could go home to get to bed on time. Because he was to bed at 10 o'clock, so he'd be up at 6 the next morning, ready to go again. But when that lesson that he had learned that night and committed to memory, when he'd get there the next day, he would just do it by memory. And if you ever raised your hand and said, "Can I ask you a question?" you could ask the question, and the way he would answer it is to go back to the beginning of the lecture, just like rewinding a tape. Go right through it. And he would give you the talk one more time. That seemed to cut down on class discussion, to tell you the truth. It didn't give him many points. I mean, evaluation forms didn't turn out too good for him. But he got to be a better and better as a teacher. Now, it's interesting. He finally found his church home. He found his church home, the Lexington Presbyterian Church, and he met Dr. William S. White. Dr. William S. White walked him through some of the doctrines that were troubling him in the areas of church government and baptism and covenant theology and predestination and all of those things. And as he worked his way through it, he then surrendered. He actually became not only a member, he became a deacon. There were three deacons. He became one. Of course, we did an offering tonight. They didn't do offerings. They would do special offerings, but you didn't do an offering. You just gave your tithe for your family pew every year. And if you hadn't given your family your tithe yet, then the deacons would come collect it. Dr. White said that Major Jackson always had 100% collection. And so he was he would be there, and he was serving, and he decided to teach a Sunday school class. And well, when he was there, he sat next to this young lady, and she got to him. That's the only thing I can tell you. He didn't know what to do. He felt real weird whenever he's around her. So one day he was having some fellowship time with one of his best friends from West Point, and who had fought with him in the war. His name was D.H. Hill, Daniel Harvey Hill, but he was teaching at Washington College. But they would still get together and talk, and he was telling him about it. He said, "You know, every time I sit down next to this Eleanor, I feel funny." He said, "Thomas, you are a fool for
for Pete's sakes, you're in love. Now you need to court her. Well, her daddy was the president of Washington College, a Presbyterian minister. So he began to court her. Now, his biggest obstacle was her sister, Margaret Preston, who after the war became known as the Poetess of the South. Quite an author she was. But at that time, she loved her sister, Eleanor, and Eleanor loved her, and she didn't want Thomas Jackson to come in between them, but Thomas finally won her over. Of course, when they got married, part of the deal was she had to go with them on the honeymoon. So she got a free trip to Niagara with her sister and her new husband, and they came back, and well, they went ahead and they built a little add-on to the president's home, what was then the president's home. It's been replaced by the one that Robert E. Lee would build later. But what was then the president's home, they did a little add-on, and Thomas Jackson and his wife moved in. And so they stayed there, and he had wonderful theological discussions with his father-in-law, Dr. George Junkin. And they would have great discussions all the time. And before long, his wife gave the news she was expecting, and then came the day of giving birth. And well, when she gave birth, the child died, and not long, just hours later, she died. That was so difficult for Thomas Jackson, and I cannot tell you everything he went through. It was 3 years long. Oh, every day he would go do his job. Today, I think I hear the term depression, but he kept working his way through it. And after 3 years, it was in the study of Romans 8:28. God causes all things to work together for good. And he grasped the verse I just read for you. And he wrote out something I go back and read every once in a while. Lessons from the divine hand of God in the homegoing of my dear wife, Ellie. There's two things you got to know about Thomas Jackson. He always wanted a family. He lost his family as a boy, lost his brother, lost his father, lost his mother. Now he lost his wife, lost the baby. So he began to write, God, if all things work together for good, what are the good things you're teaching me? The process brought him to that verse, and he embraced it for life, and it finally brought him back to a sense of balance. And his fervor with the Lord returned. Daniel Harvey Hill. Now, I know I'm in a Baptist church, but I'm just doing, you want me to be historically accurate, right? Right? Amen? Yeah. All right. Now, in my church, we do amen. Y'all do amen here? Okay. All right. I just want to make sure. So he's talking to Daniel Harvey Hill again. Daniel Harvey Hill told him, he said, well, Jackson, you need to be married. Now, you're a Christian. That means you got to get a Christian wife. And that means you got to get a Presbyterian. I'm sorry, that's what he said. I'm just quoting. That's all I'm doing. But there was a kind of an inside movement on this because Daniel Harvey Hill had married a woman by the name of Eugenia Morrison. Eugenia Morrison had five sisters. Did you know that all six of these sisters married Confederate generals? But at that time, of course, one of her sisters, who was about 4'11", very petite, very one of those aggressive personalities, that may be why she was still single. She was kind of what in those days we used to call an unclaimed blessing. And there she was, and without a husband. So when she would come and visit her sister would say, you cannot be around town without a male escort. So Thomas would actually be the male escort out of his appreciation and friendship to Daniel. In fact, he actually escorted her the morning that he was married that afternoon in the home of the president when he married Eleanor Junkin. But now 3 years later, he remembered that Mary Anna Morrison. Now, by the way, Thomas Jackson was a man of habits. You know, the first time he married a woman who was a Christian. And she was the daughter of a Presbyterian minister who was the president of what was then a Presbyterian college. Well, he got to know Marianna Morrison, and guess what she was? She was the daughter of a Presbyterian minister, pastor of Sugar Creek Presbyterian Church in Charlotte, North Carolina, Castania Presbyterian Church in Lincolnton, and the very first president of a Presbyterian college called Davidson. Now, that's a man who, when you got something working, you stay with it. So he married her.
And they began their wonderful life together. The first thing that they did was he shared with her his heart, and she agreed with him. In 1857, she with him began a Sunday school, a class for the education and the catechizing of the slaves in Rockbridge County. There weren't many, but that was his heart. And so he then began to go and got permission and went to Dr. White, and he said, "Dr. White, I'd like to have this at the church on Sundays. And there's a couple of reasons why." And Dr. White said, "We've tried that before, but it didn't work." And he said, "Oh, we can do it. Can't you hear the maxim? You can do what you resolve to do. Don't take counsel from your fears." Oh, it failed? Don't take counsel from your fears. And so Thomas Jackson and his wife began the Sunday school to the slaves and the freed blacks in the area. He immediately was accosted on the steps of the courthouse. The courthouse is still there. You can go visit. The steps are still there. You can stand there. One of his elders is who accosted him. And Colonel Preston said to him, he said, "Thomas, you are breaking the law." Now, maybe many of you don't know that, but that was back in the days when it was against the law to educate an African. And he said, "It's against the law, and I will report you." Thomas Jackson said, "Well, then you need to report me. If that's against the law, then it's a bad law. I will break it. That's one I will break. But by the way, I don't think I'm breaking it, because the law, if I'm not mistaken, says we cannot have a formal school for African Americans. Well, I don't have a formal school. I got a Sunday school. And the state can't say anything to us." So he taught them how to read and how to write, and he taught them the catechism. And by the way, I'd love for you to go over to and see Fifth Presbyterian Church in Roanoke, Virginia. It's an African-American church. And you'll find Thomas Jackson's dying words on the stained glass window, because the pastor put them there. He put them there because his daddy and mama had come to Christ through Thomas Jackson. He said, "I would have never come to Christ, or I would have never gone to seminary, and I'd never been a pastor if he hadn't done that." That was repeated many times. Molly, can I tell you one other thing? This is interesting. You remember the elder that said, "You're breaking the law, and I'm going to report you? In fact, I'll see to it you're arrested." Well, after the death of Thomas Jackson, guess who became the teacher of that Sunday school? Colonel Preston, for the next 28 years. The next 28 years. And the first superintendent for African American schools came out of that school. It was amazing what was done there. Well, Thomas Jackson is in his study one day, and he gets word that there is now war. Well, he's going to defend his country. He thinks slavery is a moral and social evil, but he is not going to let an invasion take place. So he volunteers, and he rises up through the ranks. So much I could tell you about him, but I just want to take you to one place, because y'all all call him Stonewall. You need to know. And in fact, I was kind of part of when that happened. We went to fight the Battle of First Manassas. By the way, our troops were the very first time American troops had ever been moved by railroad cars. Ours were, from Paris, Virginia, over to Manassas. And we went into the line of battle. And General Bernard B. came up, because our line was breaking. And General Bernard B. from South Carolina came up, and he said, "General," he said, "Colonel Jackson, the day is going against us. The day is going against us. What must we do?" And Colonel Jackson looked at him and he said, "Sir, go back and give them the bayonet." Bernard B. went back to his South Carolina boys, and he, along with a guy that by the name of General Nathan Shanks Evans and a guy by the name of General Wade Hampton, they turned, and it was B. that said, "Look, there stands the Virginians like a stone wall. Rally behind the Virginians. There stands Jackson like a stone wall." 5 minutes later, General B. was dead. But he was the one that gave the nickname that, by the way, General Jackson always said belonged to his troops, not to him. And so then they began this unbelievable development of Thomas Jackson. The Valley Campaign, I've already told you about that. And then he comes across the Blue Ridge, and he takes the Army of the Valley, and it joins up with General Robert E. Lee. And he comes under General Robert E. Lee, and he becomes General Lee's executive officer. And it was battle after battle after battle. And I'm out of time. I can't take you through all the battles, but I'll take you to the last one. It was Chancellorsville. We were outnumbered 3-1. 95,000 troops were in our rear. 40,000 were in our front. General Lee came up and he saw it with General Jackson. And so he took 12,000 troops and he put them against the 40,000. And then he took General Jackson and he took his entire corps of 28,000 men and he marched them up against 85, 90,000. General Jackson saw the 90,000 and he ordered a charge and it drove the 90,000 back around a little villa called Chancellorsville. That night, General Lee and General Jackson was there. I was there in the pine thicket. Snipers' bullets were going all around us. And word came from General Stuart that the right flank of the Union Army was in the air. Now, for those of you that don't know, it means they had no protection. General Lee said, we need to get at those people. Who will get at those people? And General Jackson said, I'll do it. And he said, how many men will you take? He said, I'll take my corps. Oh, I can still see the moral courage of those two men. General Jackson would take 28,000 men on a 17-mile flank march to get in the rear of the Union Army with its right flank in the corps, went in the air, his entire corps. And that would leave General Lee with 14,000 troops to stand in front of 90,000 for 18 hours. General Lee looked at him and said, then do it. The next morning, General Jackson began his move and he got his men finally in position. General Lee all day took his 14,000 men and he would actually do charges to make them think that he had a lot more than what he had. But finally, General Jackson got into the rear of the Union Army, and he looked across the line, and every single general officer that was in command of his corps, he had trained at VMI. And he turned and said, the Institute will be heard from today. And then he led them forward. They rolled up three corps, but darkness came. But General Jackson knew that any long-standing war, there's no way the South is going to win. So he tried to find a way into the rear of the Confederate Army, of the Union Army, to cut them off so they couldn't get to the river. And when he took some of his staff with him, including me, it turned dark and we realized we could not get in the rear, so it would have to be done the next day when daylight came. And we started on our way back. As we were coming back, the 18th North Carolina, part of the Tar Heel Brigade, interestingly, the general over the Tar Heel Brigade in the 18th North Carolina is buried right over here. I think there's a tiny something cemetery. It was General James Lane. Came here and taught engineering for almost 30 years after the war. And that day, it was the 18th North Carolina that cut loose a volley. Missed every single one of us. I was the one that said, stop firing. Friends, don't fire. Major Barry said from the 18th North Carolina, it's a lie. Pour it into them, boys. The next volume killed two of our staff. Still miss me. Three bullets found their mark in General Jackson. One lodged in the palm of his right hand, the other into his left forearm, the other one into his left shoulder, severing an artery. We immediately covered him. I remember casting my body over top of him because artillery fire that had been awakened from that fire from the Union Army began to rake the road. I put my body over top of him to protect him. And then when I protected him, we got him up on a stretcher and we took him back to the field hospital. His doctor, Dr. Hunter McGuire, was there. And he said, General Lee, I may have to amputate. I mean, General Jackson, I may have to amputate. And General Jackson said to him, I am under your authority. Do what seems best. He was in such pain, we could see his teeth through his lips. chloroform came upon him, he said, what a blessing. What an infinite blessing. Interestingly, on the way back, he had tried to get them to set him aside to pick up two other soldiers, but they wouldn't do it. They took him back, and they amputated his arm. He awoke the next day and said, I know you think I should be despondent, but I am not. All things work together for good. To those who love God. And to those who are called according to his purpose. Now, can I tell you a personal story about me? Don't want to make it about me. But when we cut his arm off, what are you going to do with the arm of General Jackson? Now, what we do with most arms is just throw them out there and bury them. I am not going to throw General Jackson's arm on a pile of arms over here and legs. I'm just not going to do it. So I got the arm across the road. It's called the Orange Turnpike. Across the road, less than a quarter of a mile away, was a plantation that was owned by a man named Horace Lacey. And do you know why I know about that plantation? Because I was courting his daughter, Betty. I had been there many times. And I remembered there's a family cemetery. So I took the arm, I put it in an ammunition box, I wrapped it up, and Beverly Tucker Lacey, Horace Lacey's brother, who was our chaplain, left the side of Jackson with me, and we took the arm over there and we buried it. You can go over there. It's still there today. We came back, and General Lee says, you have lost your left arm, but I have lost my right arm. I need you to get well. And so they put him in an ambulance and took him on a 28-mile ride the next day to Guinea Station so that they could put him on a railroad and get him to Richmond to get better care for him than you could get in a field hospital. So while they're there having to repair the railroads, his wife arrives. Mariana Jackson arrives on Wednesday. It's a difficult time for her. Because when she arrives, one of Thomas Jackson's best friends and hers, General Paxton from Lexington, was being buried outside the plantation office that had been turned into a hospital for General Jackson. And she was so disturbed, and she came in on Wednesday. She actually walked in bringing their new child that had just been baptized a few weeks earlier. And she brought in Julia, and she handed Julia to him. With his one remaining arm, he caressed her. When Mariana left, she looked at Hunter McGuire. She said, he is not well. And Hunter McGuire said, he is recuperating well from the amputation, but he is feverish. What Mariana saw in Hunter McGuire confirmed is he was going to get well from the amputation, but pneumonia had set in. Well, in those days, they had treatments, but there was no shots or anything. Today, you folks have penicillin. We didn't. So, would he make it or not? And in his weakened condition, it became obvious that he was not. So, on Sunday, May the 10th, 1863, Dr. McGuire said to Mrs. Jackson in our earshot, the staff, we were all there in the room. He said to her, unless the Lord intervenes, he will not live out the day. He will not live out the day. Do you want to tell him or do you want me to? And she said, he must be prepared to meet his Savior. I will tell him. It is my duty. So this dear, brave lady, who after his death would never wear any other dress but black and would spend the rest of her life telling people of the Christian manhood of her husband, Thomas J. Jackson. She goes in and sits on the bed and she looks at him and she says, Thomas, what if I were to tell you it is God's will for you to die today? Thomas Jackson, somewhat in the stupor, finally rose himself and as he would arise from it, he looked at her and he said, Mariana, if it is God's will for me to die today, then I prefer to die today. Not acquiesce, not surrender. I prefer to die today. how I shall be the infinite gainer to be translated into his presence. Now there's a man. He has performed the greatest military feat in the annals of American military history. As he and General Lee, outnumbered 3-1, divided an army into four parts and defeated the army three times its size. Shot by his own men in the fog of war. A blow from friendly fire. He's 39 years old and the most famous man in the world. Not one word of resentment. Not one word of discontent. I prefer to die today. She began to weep. He said, Marianne, I do not want sickness in a sick room. I do not want sorrow in a sick room. Brighten up. Let us sing my favorite psalm. His favorite psalm was Psalm 51. So together they sang the psalm from the Psalter, Psalm 51. He was mumbling, she was singing in her beautiful voice. And then when she finished, she could not help it again. She collapsed with her head before him, and he took his one remaining arm, bandaged up from the ball that had been removed from it. He put it upon her, and he said, Marianna, do not weep for me. Have I not always asked God that I could meet him on the Sabbath? And today is the Lord's Day. Isn't God kind to us in his providence? He then began to go through the battlefields. A.P. Hill, come up. His last command to A.P. Hill at Chancellorsville. Tell Major Hawk. And then he stopped. And the Scots-Irish blue eyes of Thomas Jackson looked straight ahead. The wall clock that is still there today in that office struck the one chime of 3:15, Sunday, May the 10th, 1863. And then General Jackson said, let's cross over the river and rest under the shade of the tree. And the catastrophe became glory as he met the tree of life that he would rest under, crossing over a cold river into the warmth of an assured new heaven. You have that confidence, not only to meet the challenges of life, but to meet the victory of Christ in death. All things work together for good. He was 39. I don't know how old you will be, but if Christ has not come back, it is appointed unto men once to die, and then the judgment. I pray that you, like Thomas, have surrendered to Christ, who carries you not only through the challenges of life, causing all things to work together for good, but will bring you to glory over the river of death, because he's the victor over sin, death, hell, and the grave. Are you in the victor? Is the victor in you? Father, thank you for the moments that we could be together. Thank you for the way that you work in and through our lives. I'm so grateful to you for the privilege to be here with my brothers and sisters in Christ. Father, if there's anyone here who has never made that commitment, may the brokenness of the blessing of grace cause them to surrender to the triumph of grace in Jesus Christ, with confidence that in life and death, for those who know him, all things work together for good. We praise your name. Amen.